You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, a very warm welcome to the RSA. My name is Georgina Chatfield. I'm Programme Manager for RSA Academies here at the RSA, and I'm delighted to welcome you here for this special Thursday lunchtime talk. It's a real pleasure to introduce today's guest speaker, Raul Martinez. Raul is a writer, artist and award-winning filmmaker. Creative Freedom is his first book and has already garnered rave reviews from everyone from Russell Brand to Noam Chomsky. It's accompanied by a highly acclaimed documentary series of the same name. Episode 1, The Lottery of Birth, which was produced, written and co-directed by Raul, premiered in 2012 and featured Vandana Shiva, Tony Benn, Howard Zinn and Steven Pinker, amongst others. It was nominated for Best Documentary at London's Raindance Film Festival and went on to win the Artivist Spirit 2012 Award at Hollywood's Artivist Festival. It's fantastic to have you here today, Raul. We all look forward to hearing what you've got to say. So without further ado, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. When I was 13, my worldview was changed by a simple idea. I was walking home from school with a friend of mine, and we were debating religion. He was religious, I wasn't. And it seemed clear to me that he only believed what he believed because of his upbringing. And a thought experiment popped into my head. I said to him, imagine you'd been swapped at birth with another baby and raised in a totally different faith. Don't you think now you'd be defending with the same passion those set of beliefs, that religion, instead of your current beliefs? Isn't it obvious that you're only saying what you're saying because of the lottery of your birth? Now, apparently it wasn't, and I think we ended up talking about football instead. But I remember the thought experiment stuck with me. That night, I was turning it over in my mind, and I realised, didn't the same thing apply to me? Everything about me, my beliefs, the language I spoke, my habits, it had all happened to me. I hadn't chosen any of it. And the more I thought about it, the more evident it became that everything about who we are can be traced to genes and environment. When you take into account our biological inheritance, the treatment we receive from parents, siblings, teachers and peers, the role models that we have access to and the opportunities that we're exposed to, when you take all of that into account, one thing becomes very clear. The machinery with which we make our decisions has been constructed by a process far beyond our control. This process determines the architecture of our neural circuitry, the way our brains are wired. It determines everything about us. Our capacity for empathy, mathematics, happiness, and courage. Our ability to concentrate, to persevere, to be self-controlled. It's all a product of this construction process. Now, here's the idea that changed my worldview. If we don't create our own brain, we can't truly be responsible for the choices that follow from it. The idea that we can be, I like to call the myth of responsibility. So, yes, we make choices, but we do so with a brain that we didn't choose, in circumstances not of our making. And by the time we have the critical faculties to question our identity, we're very much in possession of one. Of course, we can decide to change aspects of who we are and the way that we live our life, but the way in which we want to change and our success in doing so will be determined by how we already are as a result of genes and experience. The implications are far-reaching. Whether we're the star pupil or a dropout, disciplined or distracted, motivated or lazy, it's all ultimately a matter of luck. In the end, luck is what separates the rich from the poor, the saint from the sinner, the prisoner from the judge, the powerful from the powerless. So notions of credit, blame, punishment, and responsibility cease to make much sense. In other words, no one is more deserving of happiness or suffering than anyone else, whatever they may have done and whoever they are. Now, personally, I find this quite a beautiful way to look at things, but not everyone agrees. I remember the first time I told a friend of mine, he said to me, well, look, if I truly believe what you're saying, I threw myself out the nearest window. Fortunately, he's changed his mind on that. But these ideas remain particularly threatening to the systems of power and privilege that dominate our world. I should say, I don't expect you all to be convinced by these arguments after just a short talk. That's why I wrote a 500-page book on it. But it's worth pointing out that this view is increasingly taken for granted in the scientific community. And it's been endorsed by some of the greatest minds in history, from Charles Darwin to Albert Einstein. So does all this mean that free will is an illusion? Well, it all depends on how we define it. If free will refers to the ability to act in accordance with the beliefs and values we hold, to employ reason and learn from our mistakes, then it's certainly within our grasp. But if free will is a capacity to be truly responsible for our actions, then no, we don't have it. Now, if ultimate responsibility is a myth, it follows that no one is truly blameworthy. So retribution, a form of punishment in which the suffering of someone is viewed as an end in itself, well, that becomes unjustifiable. Of course, this doesn't mean we should let violent criminals or corrupt bankers walk free. We still have a right to defend society from those who pose a dangerous threat. And it's still important to establish incentives for socially beneficial behaviour. But even with incentives, we have to be careful, because they often don't work as we might think. For instance, people often assume that more severe punishments are more effective deterrents. Yet prisoners in countries with longer, harsher punishments are actually more likely, not less, to reoffend. And it's been shown that the death penalty can actually have an anti-deterrent effect, increasing crime rates rather than reducing them. The evidence indicates that it's not so much the severity of the punishment as much as the likelihood of getting caught that most effectively deters criminal behaviour. And it's telling that the lowest reoffending rate in Europe is to be found in its most humane prison, on the island of Bastøy in Norway. Now, the more fundamental objection to the logic of deterrence is a moral one. The influential American jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, and I quote, "If I were having a philosophical talk with a man I was going to have hanged or electrocuted, I'd say, I don't doubt that your act was inevitable for you, but to make it more avoidable for others, we propose to sacrifice you to the common good. You may regard yourself as a soldier, dying for your country if you like." End quote. But the truth is, mistreating or executing someone to dissuade others from socially harmful behaviour is a crude application of utilitarian logic. It's based on the proposition that we should do whatever is necessary to maximise well-being. I mean, it sounds good, but it can be used to rationalise awful behaviour. For instance, this logic could be used to justify killing one healthy person and harvesting their organs to save five sick people. You know, that might maximise well-being, but it's a terrible abuse of human rights. Yet in the area of criminal justice, this abuse, it's obscured by our cultural commitment to the responsibility myth, which makes it seem unproblematic to harm lawbreakers to benefit the wider society. Indeed, studies show that the stronger our commitment to the responsibility myth, the more we blame victims, support harsher punishments, and view the world as fair and just. But when we diminish the liberty of an individual to protect society, we have an obligation to reduce their suffering, not increase it, and where possible, to rehabilitate them. Like someone afflicted with a contagious disease, the threat they pose is not of their own making. With identical genes and experiences, anyone in this room would pose precisely the same threat. The trouble is, the more we pretend that a lawbreaker is truly responsible for their actions, the more we blind ourselves to the deeper causes of their behaviour. And this just increases the chances of reproducing the conditions that enabled that behaviour to occur. And perpetuating these conditions, poverty, inequality, corruption, is always the deeper crime. So how would a rational justice system be different? Well, at the very least, it would put an end to retribution, it would employ the logic of deterrence sparingly and only within strict humanitarian limits, and most importantly, it would prioritise rehabilitation. which decades of research has shown to be the most efficient way of lowering reoffending rates. So the path to freedom is paved with understanding, not ignorance. In this instance, understanding that the way we are is ultimately down to luck. A serial killer will make many horrendous choices, but they won't include choosing the brain of a serial killer. And the same principle applies to each of us. We can't take credit for being more virtuous, dedicated, or courageous than anyone else. Luck has been the decisive factor in the life of every person that's ever lived. Now, as a teenager, I found these ideas unnerving, but I also found them intriguing, because they raised an important question. If I wasn't the true author of my own identity, then who was? I began to see that numerous influences vie for our attention and loyalty, and the result of this battle determines who we become and the society that we create. Yet the forces that win out are rarely the most desirable. Throughout history, people have been conditioned to defend oppressive ideologies, support destructive systems, and accept pernicious lies. There doesn't seem to be a belief too bizarre or an action too appalling for humans to embrace, given the necessary cultural influences. So with these thoughts knocking around my head at the age of 17, I decided to leave formal education and create my own course of study. I became a very happy hermit. I spent my days reading, thinking, and writing, trying to understand the society that had moulded me. And one thing became obvious quite quickly. My schooling had not been a neutral process. My history teachers had taught me of the crimes of the Nazis and the courage of Churchill. But they hadn't told me that by 1939, the British Empire was already complicit in the deaths of over 20 million people, or that Churchill was both a racist and an apologist for genocide. I also learned about the lives of kings and queens, but I didn't learn about the history of how ordinary people had fought for and won many of the rights that we enjoy today. I learned about the Industrial Revolution, but not the central role that profits played in driving that revolution forward. But for all the failings of my history education, at least I was taught some history. I began to wonder why it was that in all my years of formal education, I'd never had a single lesson in economics, politics, feminism, class, or the two foundational systems of our society, democracy and capitalism. So I was being trained to function within the system, not really to understand it, and certainly not to change it. I realised that to think clearly about freedom, I had to learn about control. I thought a choice has two sides to it, the identity of the chooser and the options available. Control either side, and you control how people behave. And whether we're talking about cultivating patriotism or faith in the free market, the moulding of identities to meet the needs of political systems has always been ubiquitous. It once served the interests of monarchs to spread among their subjects the idea of the divine right of kings. It once served the interests of imperialists to spread the idea of racial superiority. And today it serves certain interests to spend billions a year marketing fast food to children. Given all this, I concluded that aspects of who we are must exist simply because they serve the forces that shape us. And I soon wondered if our belief in the responsibility myth was itself the result of such conditioning. Because not a single scientific finding supports this myth, while much of what has been discovered from physics to neuroscience contradicts it. Yet the myth is continually reinforced by major religions, by positive psychology bestsellers, by the courts, and by much of our political culture. Without a doubt, it's a highly convenient way to justify extreme inequality, inequality of wealth and power. If poorer nations in the global south can be blamed for their poverty, if addicts, refugees, prisoners, the homeless, the sick, and the unemployed can be blamed for their predicament, then social and economic systems are easily excused. Centuries of slavery, colonialism, patriarchy, and exploitation are easily dismissed, and the voice of history is silenced. The responsibility myth makes it seem that people get what they deserve. It helps to justify inequality and the economic system that produces it. Now, the relationship between economics and freedom is an interesting one. The economist Milton Friedman, one of the most influential of the 20th century, claimed that even if capitalism was less efficient than some other system, he would still favour it due to its unique capacity to deliver the freedom to choose. In his writings, he presents the market, as many still see it today, as a bastion of freedom, an institution characterised by voluntary, mutually beneficial transactions. Yet it's highly misleading to frame things this way. Imagine you're walking down the street and someone puts a gun to your head, threatening to kill you unless you hand over all your money. Now, if you agree, that would be a mutually beneficial transaction. You get to keep your life, they get to keep your money. Of course, it's not a voluntary transaction. You are compelled by circumstances to accept it. But the reality is that in the market, every single day, people are compelled by circumstance to accept all kinds of things, to do difficult, dangerous, demeaning, poorly paid work. People are compelled by need, the need to feed their children, to heat their homes, to pay their rent, to care for sick relatives. The obvious point is that poverty is itself coercive. Freedom in the market expands and contracts with spending power. Now, as uncontroversial as that may sound, it's long been denied by advocates of the free market system. They make the claim that a homeless person is as free as anyone else to, say, buy a yacht. They just happen to lack the capability to do so. The idea is that the poor have the same formal freedoms as the rich. They just lack the resources to make use of those freedoms. But really, this is just wordplay. How can a person be free to do what they are not allowed or able to do? Imagine a prison in which inmates can walk free if they pay £100,000. These free market advocates would have us believe that the poorer prisoners left behind in their cells are as free as their wealthier counterparts sitting at home with their families. I mean, it's ludicrous. Money is a kind of permission slip which enables us to access goods and services which otherwise would be denied to us by the force of the state. The less money we have, the less freedom we have. Now, there's another way in which markets are non-voluntary. Those who enter into a mutually beneficial transaction are not the only ones affected by it. Economic transactions generate costs which are not borne by those directly involved. For instance, a new car will create more traffic and more pollution, and that will impact the lives of others detrimentally. These impacts are known as negative externalities, and it's in the financial interests of corporations to externalise as many costs as possible. But really, it's a kind of theft in which you take something for nothing and leave others to pick up the bill. And this bill can be quite substantial. In 2015, a remarkable study was published by the IMF. It found that the externalised costs of the fossil fuel industry amounted to $10 million a minute. So in the time I've been speaking, the world's governments have been dumped with a bill of roughly $200 million. Another study looked at the externalities of the fast food industry. It estimated that if you included all the externalised costs of a hamburger, it should be selling for about $200. So the pervasiveness of externalities destroys the idea of efficient, self-correcting markets, characterised by voluntarism and freedom of choice. So markets can be extremely coercive institutions, enabling the few to profit from the labour and sacrifice of the many. And as power is transferred from a democratic state to the market, society moves away from the principle of one person, one vote, to that of £1, one vote. In effect, those with more money have more votes. They possess far greater power to shape the future. And concentrations of power, whether economic or political, are always a threat to freedom. When you think about it, marking a ballot takes a second. And once it's done, a typical voter's democratic participation is over until the next election. But corporate participation is continuous. Between elections, the work of lobbyists, think tanks and lawyers never ends. And the revolving door between industry and government never stops spinning. So when people speak of free markets, it's worth asking free from what? And too often, it means free from democratic accountability. To be clear, there's actually no such thing as a free market. Markets are always governed by rules, which are enforced by the state. And so the focus of the debate should be on the nature of these rules and the interests they serve. In 1819, laws were introduced banning children from working in dangerous cotton factories. But at the time, many people railed against them, saying that this was a terrible subversion of the free market. But today we barely notice such regulations because, well, we're used to them and they chime with our moral intuitions. And this is a key point. Deciding where to draw the boundaries of the market is not a technical question. It's a moral question. The positions we take will reflect our concerns, our values, and our priorities. If we believe a poor child has the same right to proper medical treatment, parental love, and education as a rich child, we are rejecting market logic. If we believe that people should have access to clean air, clean water, and healthy food, whatever the size of their bank balance, we're rejecting market logic. If we believe genes, people, qualifications, elections, and court decisions should not be bought and sold, we're rejecting market logic. So, unfortunately, the language of freedom it's been a pleasant mask placed on a destructive, unjust, and unsustainable system. We've been sold an impoverished vision of this ideal, one that elevates property rights over human rights, and one more concerned with free markets than free people. This mask of freedom is held together by some persistent illusions. Illusions about free will, illusions about democracy, illusions about free media, and illusions about the freedom long promised by advocates of capitalism. Behind these illusions is a world in which 1% of humanity now controls as much wealth as the other 99% combined. A world in which the ecological conditions for our survival are rapidly being destroyed. So against this backdrop, I think it's time to reclaim the ideal of freedom for the task of putting people and planet before profit. Because to take freedom for granted is to extinguish the possibility of attaining it. Freedom is something that we use or we lose. To be clear, there's nothing fatalistic about acknowledging the constraints on our freedom. By understanding the limits on our liberty, those rooted in our nature, as well as those imposed by society, we give ourselves the best chance of expanding the freedom that is available to us. A freedom that requires the right social, ecological, and economic conditions to flourish. Now, before I finish, I want to return to the idea I began this talk with. The idea that we're not truly responsible for who we are or what we do. Here's why I think it's so important. To transcend notions of blame and responsibility is to foster empathy and compassion. When you realise that had you lived someone else's life, you'd be doing exactly what they're doing, a profound equality emerges, one that prevents us from putting ourselves, in any deep sense, above or below anyone else. This kind of empathy can be a revolutionary force for good. I don't mean bounded empathy, which humanises the members of one group, while dehumanising outsiders. I mean, that's just another form of division. I'm talking about unbounded empathy, which flies high above the borders we impose on the world, which transcends the attributes of race, gender, religion, class, and nationality that so often divide us. That kind of empathy, when multiplied across society, is a powerful liberating force, which in this time of turmoil and crisis is our best chance of turning conflict into peace, division into unity, and hate into compassion. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Raoul. That was absolutely fascinating and given us lots and lots of different topics and themes to think about. I've just got a couple of questions first and then we'll open it out to the audience for further questions. My first question is related directly to the very last thing you said, the notion of unbounded empathy, which I think is rather a wonderful concept. How might you engender or spread unbounded empathy?
Well, I think, first of all, it's worth understanding that I think many aspects of our society encourage the opposite. I think bounded empathy is actually a very effective mechanism of control. the notion of patriotism, for instance, it encourages us to empathise and humanise the members of people who live in a particular geographical location. It seems a very positive notion, but by elevating those people, you know, logic dictates that you, to some extent, dehumanise, you know, the rest of humanity. I remember researching the final chapter on empathy and finding that the way in which soldiers was trained kind of employed this logic. It's quite hard to get soldiers to the point where they're ready to kill. And so various forms of training have been experimented with over the decades. And actually the most effective is not to kind of focus on hatred for the enemy. It's to focus on kind of love, empathy for your fellow soldiers, for your particular unit. And so it's all about channeling empathy to where it's politically useful. And I think political leaders, religious leaders over the centuries have expertly used this very powerful human force in ways that serve their own ends. So if we're talking about how to expand unbounded empathy, I think we need to question and challenge the mechanisms in place which routinely encourage us to identify with particular groups that serve particular interests. And, you know, every time we go to war, we see this. We see it in the press coverage of the way deaths are covered across the world. In the book, I have a bit on Madeleine McCann, you know, a tragic story of one girl who goes missing. But the amount of press coverage that one incident received compared to, for example, 500,000 children in Iraq that died during the as a result of the sanctions imposed by US and UK policy. Most people don't even know about that. They've never heard. That's 500,000 children who've died because of, you know, the actions of our governments. So I think it's pervasive, this practice of channeling human empathy to where it's politically useful. So yeah, I would just say we have to question that. We have to resist the various trends in our society that encourage xenophobia, racism, sexism, and they are pervasive. And we're seeing it right now with the refugee crisis. So really, I do believe it's a revolutionary force. I mean, if you could generally shift culture in such a way that people truly believed and acted upon the idea that the life of every single person is equally valuable, it would force fundamental and dramatic changes in our society.
Yeah. It does seem that a theme like empathy, with the coverage it's got, I'm thinking of people like Brené Brown that speak very articulately about the power of empathy, an RSA short that we've got that speaks to that very subject as well, that it's becoming something that's more and more in our discourse, in a sense, you'd hope would be a positive thing for people to reflect on in relation to what you're saying. I also really like the analogy you made about being mugged and the free market, and about people being compelled by their circumstances to behave in particular ways. And I wondered, what advice would you give to somebody who feels that they don't have power in their lives, that they actually have to follow a particular course of action and they're unable themselves to behave in any other particular way? We think a lot at the RSA about the power to create, which actually is a term you talk about in your book.
Yes.
The notion that people have or should have the ability to turn their own ideas and aspirations into action. And what advice would you give to someone that feels that they just don't have that power?
Well, I think I'd begin by saying society is set up in such a way to make many people feel that. If you can take hope away from people, they become less of a threat to the established status quo. So it's a radical act, it's a political act, to find hope. But of course the truth is many people are in very difficult circumstances. And I think the way out of that is to realise, yeah, on your own, as an individual, up against a system which does disempower you, I think opportunities seem quite bleak. But history teaches us that when we join together, when we find others in our situation, and there are many others out there, I mean, there are so many groups out there doing fantastic work, we actually can become quite powerful. And it actually doesn't take huge numbers. Small numbers of dedicated people working towards a common goal can actually achieve profound shifts in society. We've seen that again and again. So I would say, look, don't let them win. Optimism is a political strategy. It's not a kind of airy-fairy ideal. It's the beginning of all social change. I would say find others, friends, family, colleagues in your community, and speak with them about what you can do. There are always local issues, and you can broaden out from there. You can join organisations. I also would say, and this applies to everyone, whatever your kind of economic or political situation, question yourselves. And we hear this a lot. I mean, a lot of thinkers, you know, repeat this idea of the importance of questioning everything. And to me, it does seem a foundational idea because our choices are a reflection of our identity. But identity has been constructed by forces we don't control, from the education system to our family to the media. And so to some extent, we are all harbouring beliefs and values and habits which reinforce the status quo, reinforce a system which actually we don't benefit from. And sometimes we're quite loyal to these beliefs. We cling to them and defend them. And so I would say to everyone that to some extent, deepening our freedom depends on creating some distance between what I call our inherited identity and ideals of truth and objectivity, and to kind of question fairly systematically our assumptions and beliefs, and really ask, does this further my deepest values, living this way and believing these things and voting for this party? Or actually, is that just a result of habit and what my parents did or what I've read in The Sun this morning? But it applies to us all, yeah. So I'd say questioning and optimism and joining with other people would be core ingredients.
And in relation to that idea of questioning, it's also picking up on your slightly unconventional end to your formal education. And in respect of young people and how they kind of might start to learn how to question what is actually normal around them, is there a particular role you think schools should have that they perhaps don't play currently that you would recommend was something which was part of education outside of the kind of standard curriculum and citizenship type lessons?
Gosh, there's a lot. I think we should change the education system really fundamentally. But just before kind of specifying, you know, in any sense how that could be done, I think we have to realise that an education system always functions to serve the needs of a society. And so if you're going to change the education system, you need to create a society which can actually take those individuals and accommodate them rather than simply kind of put a stop to the ambitions and kind of visions for a life that they have for themselves. So changing society and changing the education system, actually, they'll happen in tandem. Mm-hmm. If you have an oppressive society, if you have a society where a lot of people are actually going to end up in very poorly played, unsatisfying work, then there are strong interests kind of pushing the education system in a direction that creates people who are prepared for that kind of work, who are used to doing rote activity, who don't expect to do creative or stimulating work. And so to some extent, I think the education currently functions as simply training for a disempowered life. Mm-hmm. So if you want empowered, questioning people, you need a society that can accommodate those people. As to how I would change society, the education system, well, I think for a start, you have to look at the teacher-student dynamic and quite early on highlight the power imbalance that exists there. Mm-hmm. Paulo Freire, who was a kind of revolutionary thinker, in the area of education, he's a Brazilian educator. He always talked about the importance of what he called problematizing this dynamic between teacher and student, because you can't transcend it. But what you can do is explain to the students, look, an education can never be neutral. What I'm going to tell you is going to reflect what I think is important. It's going to reflect my biases, and that's going to be true whatever class you go to, whatever country you're in. So you have to question what you hear. You have to read around. You can't trust that this is objective or complete. And you can go further in that and actually explain what your biases are as a teacher. I once interviewed the historian Howard Zinn, who many of his students regarded as, you know, their favourite teacher. And he would actually tell his students, you know, my bias is against racism. My bias is for a more democratic and more equal society. Now, that's going to inform the history I choose. And he wrote a famous book called The People's History of the United States. He thought it was essential to speak about and teach history from the perspective of those who are often ignored or marginalised, those who had been oppressed, the slaves rather than slave owners, you know, peasants rather than kings. And I think that's a starting point as a teacher to kind of alert your student to the pitfalls of a formal education. Mm-hmm. I also think lessons in power and the history of control should be an essential part of any education. And economics. I mean, most of society is economically illiterate, including a lot of economists, because of the training they receive. You know, they're taught neoclassical economics, which is just one tiny sliver of the possible spectrum of economic ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get taught Marxist economics or ecological economics or feminist economics, post-Keynesian economics. I mean, there are a whole load of very sophisticated schools of thought which are largely ignored. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I could talk for a long time about how you could change the education system, but I think at its core, at least in the short term, the best we can do is encourage people to try and take as much responsibility themselves for filling in those gaps and creating a society that could accommodate a different kind of education system.
Great, thank you very much indeed. Right, let's open up now to yourselves here in the room.
Thank you. David Alexander, I'm a fellow of the RSA. I'd like to get your perspective on Brexit. Was it an expression of freedom, or do you think it was something different?
Pause that
for
1 second. I want to take the gentleman in the front row as well.
Okay. Hello, Jerome Toole. My question was, once you've let go of the myth of responsibility and you've seen that for what it is, what are you left with? Are you left with more responsibility, any more free will? Is it a sliding scale? Is there something beyond that? Or are you just left as an observer of a person without free will? And if so, who's that observer? Do they have agency, or are they just an observer?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right. So Brexit. I think Brexit, and actually similarly the phenomenon in the States right now with Donald Trump, I think it's a product of two trends in Western society. The first is the impoverishment and disempowerment of large swathes of the population over a period of decades, so rising, soaring inequality, which creates a situation in which many people realise, hang on, I'm not in a great position here. Things are getting more expensive, I can't afford an education, I can't pay my rent. But it's one thing to know that there's a problem, it's another to diagnose that problem correctly. And I think the other trend in our society has been that of indoctrination. And scapegoating. And there's been so much of that, and we've seen it recently in this country with the austerity narrative, which, you know, tried to blame the most vulnerable in society for the mistakes of bankers, mistakes of the establishment. So I think a lot of people believe, because they've been told over many years, that actually the source of their problems is down to, you know, immigrants, it's down to potential refugees, it's down to, oddly enough, the people who don't have much power in society. They're the ones who are causing all the problems. So I think when you put those two things together, and then in the States, it's quite extreme when you look at the output of something like Fox News and the kind of conditioning that people have been receiving over long periods. People, it becomes possible to think that Donald Trump is on your side and that, you know, he's a solution to your problems. So, I mean, these are complex questions and areas. I don't think that completely covers, you know, every nuance of it. But I think in general, yeah, it's a product of indoctrination and disempowerment over long periods. So I don't view it necessarily as an expression of freedom, because I think, you know, I define freedom as a kind of form of creativity, the capacity to use our choices to serve our values. And that requires that we understand what we truly value and how best to achieve our values. That's an ongoing process. I don't think any of us have got it completely worked out. That's why questioning is so essential. But yes, I'll leave the Brexit question there. Hope that went some way. And your question. So where are we left once we acknowledge the myth of responsibility? Well, you're left in the present with choices to be made in your life. You know, you're alive. There are still things you care about. You love your family. You might be appalled at the injustices in our world. You might want to do something about those things. You know, the myth of responsibility doesn't undermine our values, doesn't undermine the passion we have or the capacity to live a rich, beautiful life. It just means we can't take credit for those things or blame others for where they happen to be in their life. So for a long time now, I've seen the world this way. It's become very familiar, this perspective. Yet it's not at all undermined the passion I have for wanting to use my choices to serve a vision of a more inspiring, more beautiful, more meaningful future. It hasn't undermined my desire to be a good brother or son or partner. So in no sense has it taken meaning away. But it has, to some extent, taken away the desire to blame or the notion that I can take credit for my achievements or anything like that. I mean, I would say in my own life it's been quite positive. And there have been people like Albert Einstein who lived their life believing this and did marvellous things, you know, fought against nuclear proliferation, changed the way we think about the universe and so on and so on. So I think it's an idea that can take a while to get used to, and obviously each person has to familiarise themselves and make sense of it, see if the argument is compelling, and if so, how you respond to it. But on a personal level, it hasn't really had any kind of negative impact.
Gentleman in the green top, please, first.
Hi, Matthew Batchelor. How do we shift the debate around which are the important freedoms to have? If I walk into a mobile phone shop, I'll be confronted with a wall of choice. But actually, you know, if people say to me, oh, you know, you only need two or three different choices in this shop, that's quite sufficient, that's enough mobile phones already, then I might get quite upset and say, oh, actually, I want more freedom to choose here. Whereas if I walk the rather polluted streets of London, that's presented as an inevitable external cost of my freedom to drive, if you like. So how do we get people thinking about different types of freedoms and potentially giving some up in order to have others?
Great, thank you.
Thank you. I'm a member of the public. About 30 years ago, there was an experiment, a neurological experiment in the United States, which the results which shattered my ideas of freedom and free will. What they discovered was that when we are conscious of an action, like picking up a glass of water, as you just did, they discovered that the brain spiked 0.15 and 0.3 of a second before the event. Now, that tells me that free will, freedom to choose, etc., are a problem. This experiment was repeated in various centres around the world, and they had exactly the same range. Now, that tells me that perhaps the brain is trying to protect us in some way by interacting with the environment and then telling us what we should do. On that basis, concepts of heroism, for example, somebody charging at a machine gun post, is because the brain is telling them to do so, and the same with other actions. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, so first of all, I think our hierarchy of freedoms is going to depend on the values that we have. And we need to interrogate our values individually and collectively. And there's always going to be disagreement to some extent about what freedoms are most valuable and where you draw the line, etc., etc. But there's also going to be a lot of agreement. For example, I think we can all agree that the source of all our freedoms, first and foremost, is the environment. There's no freedom, there's no civilization, there's no humanity without clean air, without a climate existing within a particular band of temperatures. So, I mean, you know, there's lots to be said about this, but I would start there. I'd start with the environment. In the book, I have a chapter on the environment and the climate. And for me, it's just the most terrible indictment of our system, of our economic and political system, the way we've dealt with the climate crisis. We've had, for the last decade or so, about $500 million a year spent on propaganda trying to discredit climate science. We've known about the dangers of rising temperatures and carbon for decades now, and yet CO2 has continued to shoot up year on year. The only kind of halt that there's been was during the economic crisis. There's less production for a while. And it forces us, really, if you take the science seriously, to look closely at notions like growth and economic growth, which is still a controversial area for a lot of people, and I just don't understand it. I think some people are more ready to accept the destruction of humanity than they are to question capitalism, because it's such an ingrained... We've been subjected to propaganda for decades about, you know, the all-powerful magic of the system. I mean, just to throw some numbers out there, an economy which grows at 3% a year, every 156 years will become 100 times bigger. Now, what that means is that after 468 years, the economy will be a million times bigger than it was. And if you add 156 to that, that will be 100 million times bigger, and so on and so on. It's completely and utterly unsustainable. It's not a viable social goal. So I would start with saying, look, we can debate freedom in these areas, but let's agree that we need a planet to even just have that debate. And move from there. So there's more to be said, but I'll leave that point there. And your question, so you were talking about the Libet experiments, weren't you? Now, there are many interpretations to those experiments. Not everyone comes away with the conclusion that we lack free will. And, of course, I actually tend to avoid the term free will because it comes with so much baggage and people get very nervous when you begin to call it into question. I think there are certain definitions of freedom and free will, as I talked about, that we do have and are meaningful, and others that we don't. It partly depends on what you identify with. Do you identify with your unconscious mind, your unconscious brain, as much as your conscious? If you do, then the Libet experiments become less threatening. And that's certainly a finding of recent neuroscience, that actually the majority of our decision-making takes place unconsciously. Some might argue all of it. I mean, these questions are still open for debate. But to some extent, that's still us. I mean, you know, if you identify it, then it's with it, then it's less problematic. I mean, that's all I would say to that.
We've got time for some more questions. There was one at the back there.
Hi, Jennifer Shees Govinden. I'm a social psychologist. I'm not sure what insights Steve Pinker was sharing, but one of the big insights of his recent book on the decline of violence was that, you know, our evolved brain has the capacity both for a lot of aggression and nastiness and for a lot of empathy and social coordination and cooperation. And I just wonder what you think about the kind of societal conditions that he says are more likely to bring out the nicer side of us, the empathic, perhaps even the unboundedly empathic side, rather than the others, particularly two of them. One is the consolidation of power in the state, which itself is a very kind of violent process, but he argues is needed to so that you have a neutral arbiter of disputes. And then the second is the kind of proliferation of non-zero-sum economic interactions that the free market enables. And in particular, that I think what he's drawing from there is a correlation across nations between market integration and altruism and empathy as displayed in experimental games.
So first of all, I haven't actually read Pinker's book, but I do know that... So his whole thesis is that over time, humanity has become more peaceful, there's less violence in society. And it's actually a really controversial idea, and it's one that I would challenge. First of all, for most of humanity, we didn't have civilization, so we can, you know, with the agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago, we have the beginnings of civilization. And before that, for about 90% of our species' existence, we lived as hunter-gatherers. Now, he cites two studies which indicate that war was prevalent during that period. That's actually an incredibly controversial claim, and it goes against the majority of research in that area and has been disputed by numerous experts in the field. And it's basically just two papers he's looking at, and there's a book published by Oxford University Press, edited by Douglas P. Fry, which is pretty much dedicated to debunking that conclusion. So I would start there and just question that initial premise. As far as, you know, what is going to cultivate a freer society and a kind of more humane society, I would kind of counter some of the research you cited with research which shows that the more powerful we are, the higher up we are in terms of earning power and social status, the less empathy we have for people lower down the social scale. So inequality, and this has been shown kind of in numerous forms of research have converged on this conclusion, that inequality actually breeds various forms of essentially selfishness and dehumanisation. And I think that's necessarily the case, because people with a lot of privilege, and maybe a lot of us in this room have various forms of privilege that many others don't, it's a lot easier to enjoy that privilege if you can rationalise it somehow. Somehow say that you deserve it. Maybe you're smarter than others. Maybe you've worked harder, etc., etc. If you don't believe that, suddenly it's hard to actually reap the utilitarian benefit of all that privilege and all that wealth and all those opportunities, because you might feel a little bit guilty. So I think the way forward is to create a much more equal society. It's to, as we talked about before, to question all the mechanisms of control which actually divide us, which split us up. The institution of patriarchy, which I think isn't talked about enough, is a huge part of this. How we're all, men are conditioned to, it's a huge generalisation, but nevertheless important. We're conditioned to not share our emotions, to hold, to kind of dominate others, and to associate our status with our work, and et cetera, et cetera. I think there are all kinds of problems with the way that we're conditioned, which we need to challenge, and that's the route to creating a fairer society and a more humane society. I think almost by definition, a very unequal society can't be a humane society, because the majority of the people aren't really benefiting from it. Anyway, I'll leave that question there.
Hiya, I was just basically wondering, going on the logic earlier that everyone's born into situation by luck and circumstance and genetics, what would your argument be for people who've come from, kind of against all odd circumstances and prospered and come from low socioeconomic backgrounds and done well from it?
So, yeah, it's a good question. How do you explain people who come from difficult backgrounds and lead remarkable lives and achieve wonderful things? In the book, I talk about the butterfly effect and chaos theory, the idea that just very small changes in initial conditions can lead later on within a system to radical changes in the outcome. And we see this in the natural world all the time, and I think the same is true with the trajectory of a human life, that very small things early on, and it might be down to a genetic influence, or it might be down to the example of a relative or a book you read, or even tiny things at a particular point in your life. The weather might mean that you make a particular decision on a particular day that sends you down that path in life rather than that path in life. Every identity is unique, and every context for a life is unique, and so we should expect to see such examples that you're referring to of people doing unexpected things. But as I say in the book, just because every now and then one person wins a lottery, it doesn't mean that everyone else was destined to lose it.
And then also, I think earlier in response to one of the other questions, you were saying if people kind of change their mentalities and they're aware of the world kind of coercing them into thinking they can't do things, if everyone took this logic, do you think the world would level out again realistically, or would we end up with people who are born with ideologies that go against it?
I think there are always going to be people, because I think, first of all, it's still quite a provocative idea for many. It's going to take a while to actually change our culture in that respect. And even if you do succeed in doing that, there are always going to be people who disagree, and always people, even if they accept it, who say they could use the myth of responsibility, kind of transcending that idea, to justify being selfish and less helpful, and that maybe excusing themselves from bad behaviour. I mean, any idea, any important idea can be used to justify different things. That has no bearing on, I don't think, the validity of the idea, but it's just the fact that, the theory of evolution can be used to emphasise cooperation and empathy and various inspiring aspects of human nature, or it can be used to create something like social Darwinism. And I think it's the same with this idea.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Raoul. Thank you all very much for your questions today. I'm sure there's loads more that we could ask you because it's just such a rich theme of thinking. But now to thank you very much for your questions and to join me in thanking Raoul Martinez.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.